Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We have become so mesmerized by the sputters and dying sparks of the technology boom that we stop thinking about the economic importance of that other boom, the baby boom. A new study by the Aspen Institute says the remarkable economic growth of the past two decades had a lot to do with all those people starting their careers and spending their prime working years together. The next 20 years, though, we'll see no such new rush of skilled workers. So at the very moment when people are trying to figure a way out of the current economic mess, this new warning says the whole system is askew. The authors of the report say dramatic change is required in the way that workers are trained, in the way that they're paid, and in the way that foreign workers are encouraged to come to this country. So, Connection listeners, we want to hear from you on this. How is your workplace changing? Or more to the point, how should it be changing? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can join us online. We're at theconnection.org. Now, in order to create the report, the Aspen Institute brought together people from all sides of the policy debates over a five-year period. And I'm joined today by three of them. David Elwood directed the report. He is a labor economist at Harvard. He's with me in the studio. Jim Oesterreicher is a former CEO of JCPenney. And Beth Schulman is the former vice president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. Jim joins us from a studio in Texas. Beth is in Washington. Beth's also author of the forthcoming book about low-wage workers, The Betrayal of Work. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I'm going to start, I think, David, with a quote that appeared under your name in the Washington Post yesterday. You're writing about accounting scandals, CEO malfeasance, other corporate offenses, but you say this: on this Labor Day, workers, businesses, and policymakers have something far more serious to be concerned about. Sort of caught my attention, because when you talk about long-term trends and things that ought to change, you don't necessarily think of them always as serious and things that need to be addressed right now.
Well, but actually, we've just had an important lesson that if we don't think things that are long-term trends seriously, we can get in real trouble. We see it with September 11th and everything else. We know for sure that our economy is changing radically, and the reason is a lot to do with those baby boomers you just talked about. When they came of age, there was this massive boom in the number of workers. They got much more education than their parents did and their grandparents did. So as they became the new workers, they created an automatic push, a kind of wind at our backs for the economy. And even along this time, a lot of low-skill workers were getting hurt. Now, for the next 20 years, those baby boomers, they become the retirees. They're replaced by their kids. Well, their kids are not more numerous. And furthermore, they haven't gotten more education than their parents. And as a result, we're going to see all of a sudden the wind turn sharply in our face, and the economy is going to struggle with productivity, with workers, and low-skill workers may get hammered even harder.
Now, Jim Oesterreicher, in your years with JCPenney, you saw a lot of women coming into the workforce. And in the report's synopsis, it's saying that that's something else that we will see changing fairly dramatically, comparing the last 20 years to the next 20 years.
Yeah, Dick, that's true. The women in the workforce have been a mighty engine for this economy, and where today the majority of households are both are dual income. And it brings along all kinds of lifestyle problems, care of children, sharing of household duties, who's going to take the children to the doctor, etc. Now a number of new women coming into the workforce is pretty well leveled off, but we still have the serious implications of child care and other lifestyle opportunities.
And Beth Schulman, you've spent a lot of your time representing the interests of unionized workers. When you look at what was and what's ahead, are you on board with this idea that we've got dramatic change ahead, something that needs to be addressed and done now?
Absolutely, Dick. Even in the best of times, the very best of times, One-third of the full-time workers weren't having health insurance. One-half didn't have pensions. One in five were unable to earn enough without social assistance. You have one in four workers making less than $8.75 an hour in the best of times. So when you look down the road, if we don't do something dramatic about ensuring that work is rewarded and that every American takes place and has their share of prosperity, we're going to have a large group of people who are essentially outliers in our society, people who we all claim are doing absolutely the right thing, getting up every day, working hard. So absolutely, I think that we need to really focus on work being rewarded and ensuring that there's basic safety nets for all American workers.
I want to take that point a little bit further, Beth, but before I do, just quickly back to David in the studio here for a little backgrounder on how all this came about. The Aspen Institute, this gang that you gathered together, the 5 years of consultations. Did you know when you began where you were headed with this?
No, not at all. This is a group called the Domestic Strategy Group, and was pulled together with the perhaps naive hope that you could bring together Republicans and Democrats, leaders from business, from government, from labor unions, from communities, mayors and so forth, advisors to, you know, to presidents and so on, and find a way to seek common ground in domestic policy for really critical issues over the long term. You know, most of what we hear coming out of Washington, coming out of our state capitals and so forth, is an awful lot of noise fighting around the margins on some small thing. Well, this group said, let's look at the future of work and see what's coming. And what we saw surprised us. These dramatic changes in demography and so forth were immediately obvious when you took the long view, but no one was taking the long view. And as a result, you know, we become preoccupied on the current recession or the accounting scandals of today. But, you know, we know in 5 and 10 years, this country is going to have more and more inequality, more and more social schisms if we don't use this as an opportunity to do the other, to use every worker, to move every worker up. And I think this is what was interesting is we not only saw a crisis, but we saw this as an opportunity to help bring the nation closer together as opposed to let it just ride out and things could actually get worse.
Jim, there is a list of recommendations for the politicians and for corporate executives and for the leaders of labor unions. But, I mean, if you put your finger on the one that you think matters the most in the 20 years ahead, what do you think? I mean, if you had a chance to say this is the key to the report, this is the key piece of advice, what would you say that it is?
They're all important. I would probably prioritize build a more skilled and upward mobile workforce is number one. And then number two would probably be provide a more supportive workplace for families.
When you say a more skilled workforce, do you mean a better educated workforce, or are you talking more about workplace skills?
Well, there's absolutely millions of different kinds of jobs requiring different skill levels. But every job requires a skill level appropriate to its description. And at every level, at the highest level, particularly in medicine and so forth, are very short on nurses and in many cases doctors. On the entry level and in the retail industry, the service industry, many of those jobs, lower-end jobs, go begging, both for lifestyle and for skill.
Beth, what about you? What's your headline recommendation in this?
Well, my headline recommendation is we need to reward work. You know, when we talk about skills, you know, child care workers, nursing home workers are very skilled jobs, yet they're making $8 an hour and have very little benefits. So it seems to me there's a couple things we need to do. We need to reward work and give every working American the basics to support themselves and their family.
But Beth, that's never been, you know, I mean, it's always been an ideal, but it's never actually worked in a capitalist country
really,
like this, has it?
There really are. Certainly today, we face a worse situation where we have a real divide in terms of income and benefits in the United States, far greater than certainly during the 60s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. So I think we really need to reassess what we mean by a united America. We've talked about it certainly a lot in terms of 9/11, but I think we need to start thinking about what it means as a society when we have the kind of inequality we have. The other thing is I agree with Jim wholeheartedly, and we certainly agreed during the Aspen Institute dialogues, that we need to really change these workplaces to ensure that women and caregivers can go to work, make sure that they have childcare, quality childcare to take care of their families, have the kind of flexibility they need to take a child to the doctor or go to school. So we really need to look at the restructuring of our workplaces to ensure that every American who has a family can take those jobs and also make sure that the children have a healthy environment to prosper.
And this is David Elwood again. The thing is, one of the critical parts of this report is it says we're going to need a combination of things. We're going to need every worker. And that means we've got to find a way to make work pay. But, you know, the truth is there are ways to make work pay that this group could agree on. Yeah, the group couldn't possibly agree on a higher minimum wage. You can imagine the debate over that. But the group can agree that the earned income tax credit, which is a terrible name, but for a wonderful policy that's like a pay raise to working poor families. It's been a policy that's been expanded by Republicans and Democrats alike. It occasionally comes under fire. This group believes in it because what it does is it says to working people, when you go to work, when you play by the rules, we're going to make sure you have a little more income to support your family, up to $4,000 more in terms of tax credits. Health care. Now, you know, there's no reason to find way. We can't find ways of tax credits, some other strategies to ensure that workers get health care. And as they move from job to job, they don't lose their benefits. So that's a critical starting point. But I would also agree with Jim. You know, in the end of the day, if we can't find a way to take existing workers and make them more skilled, make them more connected to specific workplace practices, it's going to fail. And frankly, our old training systems among employers, they often do a great job. But, you know, employers don't want to train their competitors' workers. And the high turnover new economy often leads people to want to do less training. Government can fill the role, but they've had these sort of disembodied training programs unconnected with very specific workplace needs. So we go through and sort of say, look, if we work on many fronts at the same time, yeah, it's a little more complicated, but that's what this group was about, the long term. We can find a way to use every worker, move them up, create upward mobility, and make the society more successful at all levels.
Absolutely. I think that was the impressive part of this group, is that there were a lot of solutions that everyone agreed on. And one of the things in problem with training is actually the lower wage workers get the least training. So it's really trying to, and we certainly this group agreed on a variety of strategies of linking training to various industries that both improve the industries and improve worker skills. So there's a variety of measures that I think business, labor, academics agreed on in terms of making sure that work was working for everyone and that we were finally providing the training needed to ensure that workers could be mobile.
I think one moment when we, the group, knew that we could find a common ground was sitting in a Bronx, in the Bronx, and a community home health care associate. And this is a program for mostly for welfare mothers, people coming off welfare. And the idea is they carefully screen folks that would be good home health workers.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to interrupt you, David, because I know the example that you're about to tell me, and I want you to have the time to tell it. We're
great.
Coming up to a break. So, Connection listeners, decent wages for hard work. A little more training, a little more logic in the training, and a little more focus from the politicians on the way that we link training and education to the workers of the next 20 years. Is this what we should be focusing on right now rather than the CEOs and their high pay raises? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this...
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. On this day after Labor Day, we're talking about the changing face of the American workforce and some new ideas that have come from an organization called the Aspen Institute. With me on the program today, Jim Ostreicher. He's former chief executive officer of JCPenney. Beth Shulman is former vice president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. And David Elwood is director of the Aspen Institute and a labor economist at Harvard University. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're interested in your workplace and how you see it changing and whether or not you think it should be changing in a different way. Before we went away for the break, David, we were talking about the field trips that people went on as a part of drafting this report. You were talking about a healthcare facility in the Bronx.
Yeah, we went on a lot of field trips because we wanted to see a variety of different workplaces. Of course, we had a lot of representation there, but we wanted to see them. One of the most memorable was this program in the Bronx, and we sat there. Ann Richards, former governor of Texas, Jerry Jasnowski, head of the National Association of Manufacturers, people on this program and so forth, and heard a young woman, actually a middle-aged woman from Puerto Rico who had previously been on welfare and so forth, talking about what it was like to be a home health care worker and what this program had meant to her. And this is a program that does the kind of training we believe in. It focuses on specific needs in specific industries and takes people who have the potential and trains them for it. Well, this woman was...
This is a federal government training program?
This is a local training program that gets some support from the government.
Right.
But we should come back to it because these local programs that really do it right often hate the government almost as much as small business for all the regulations and so forth. But this woman was talking about what it was like changing bedpans. And this group sat enrapt, hearing her talk about caca and other kinds of unmentionables. And you know, at the end of that, every single person had the same reaction. We came up to her and hugged her and so forth and said, when we get to that state, we hope you're there for us. Because her point was she wanted to stay with the same patient as long as she could. She talked about what folks needed and what they wanted. And that was the kind of warmth and caring and so forth. And every person in that room realized we could well be in that situation. Many of our parents already are. And there was the kind of person we wanted helping us. Well, this was a person who had been on welfare, who barely gets by, who often in other programs wouldn't get health benefits. That's the kind of thing where we could all be better off because we're going to need those people to be a part of our economy.
You know, your story illustrates one aspect of the report that I wanted to hear a little bit more about, and that is this is a woman from Puerto Rico. This is a country largely built on the working skills of immigrants. And immigrants continue to change the face of the American workplace, perhaps no more so than in places like Dallas, Texas, Jim Ostreicher. And why then can't we just look to the immigrants of the next 20 years to keep the economy growing?
Well, I think the issue is bigger than just immigration. You have the total workforce to consider and how you integrate immigration into the workforce. There are today many occupations that are being almost exclusively filled by immigration. But those people also need to be integrated into the United States, need to be integrated into their communities, need to be educated into the American institutions.
Don't they do that themselves? Don't the immigrants who really want to find the right job and the right school for their kids take care of that in large part on their own?
I think it's a small percentage that would be the case. Certainly there are examples.
Dick, I mean, you've got immigrants coming to this country not speaking the language. You know, in other words, there has to be a program or a way to ensure that they're fully integrated into the American economy. But I think a more important issue is to ensure that if workers come to this country, that they have the same rights that other workers have. We certainly don't want a system in which we have merely temporary workers who have the vulnerability of being abused by their employers because they don't have the same rights as workers in these United States. So I think when we look at the immigration issue, we're going to have to look at kind of all workers and ensure that all workers have some power to ensure that they can not only work in the United States and be productive and do the things we all want to happen in the United States, but that they can get their fair share. We don't want a immigrant population that is losing out and is essentially a second-grade citizenry because we've denied them the rights that other workers have in the United States.
There's a bit of a clash here, David, in that since September 11th, there's been a lot of talk in America about ways of restricting immigration, and yet skilled immigrants will be a key part of the new workforce.
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, skilled immigrants are seen as the biggest security threat in some ways. There's talk about reducing education and so forth. look, our immigration policy is this patchwork of bizarre combination of temporary and permanent, legal and illegal, family-based, economic-based, and so forth. This report doesn't say there's any one right answer here. What it says is we have to become much more thoughtful. September 11th is a wake-up call. But if what we do is simply say, okay, let's shut the doors, we're going to shoot ourselves in the foot because we're going to need workers. We're going to need new people that are a part of the American fabric as they've always been. This is a country built on immigrants. It will be even more so in the future. The point of this report is to sort of say, look, let's not just say more or less. Let's say more thoughtful. And let's think about what we need. And then let's, as we're particularly, I would say, critical of the sort of temporary worker movement that some people are attracted to. You know, if you want someone who's going to be part of the American fabric, that's the worst idea. And think about bringing in skilled temporary workers and sending them back to compete with us in the future. No, we want folks that'll be part of the American mainstream. So the idea here is let's become more thoughtful. Let's, yes, take into account security concerns. Absolutely, that's paramount. But let's also recognize that we're going to need workers that are part of the American fabric, that share the American dream, and I think they're there. And we also, Jim's point about integration is really critical. If you have people that don't have any rights, that are working 60, 70 hours a week, the time for integration is much more limited. And oftentimes we find that the children of the second generation right. often are doing worse. And that's a real worry. And again, I think we can work on that because we're going to need every worker we can find.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to go to Boston, Massachusetts. Sam's on the line. Hi, Sam.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Well, I have two thoughts that I'd like reactions to. One of them has to do with age discrimination. The other has to do with training. In the world of age discrimination, at 56 years old, I can tell you I have had to basically reinvent myself twice. College graduate, 1968, very leading edge of the baby boom. In the early 90s, I found myself having to reinvent myself out of my originally chosen career into a new one. I found both.
What did you do and what did you switch to, Sam?
Well, I was in broadcasting for
right.
the first portion of my life. First program director of one of the major rock stations here in Boston. And I did that for about 22 years. Then I had to say goodbye to Marconi and hello to Bill Gates, which was a very tough, oblong or oval peg through a round hole. The bottom line, though, is that multiple times I found myself in pure age discrimination situations, either, on the way out or in the situation of interviewing. And of course, you can't prove those most of the time. So my quick comment here for a reaction is this. One of the worst parts of American corporate rot for the last 20 years isn't just what we've seen in the last 6 months or year. It is also this total lack of care and concern for the society, i.e. the impact of firing workers in their 40s and early 50s, people who are trying to maintain families at this stage, bringing up kids into college, and also save for their own futures. They're cut off at the legs at the prime of their earning life, and that's going on systemically. Then the other part of the problem
let's
is...
Let's just take that, if we can, Sam, because it's a clear picture that you've painted. Beth, the whole idea that Sam is describing in the report, there's specific references to making use of workers in their latter years. Is there any way of formalizing that, of making sure that the type of discrimination he's talking about, as hidden as it may be, doesn't happen?
Well, a few points. First, it seems to me that it's enormously short-sighted on the part of business, because they're going to need every worker they can, and certainly the experienced workers that David was referring to. Obviously, we need to be more vigilant in terms of enforcing the age discrimination laws. But there's another issue that I think Sam alluded to, is the lack of power that workers have in today's economy. And certainly coming from the labor movement, the fact that most workers don't have unions today, and the difficulty in organizing and having a real voice so that you have some counterbalance to employers in terms of their practices, I think is another crucial issue that we're seeing certainly with the corporate abuses today and the lack of power and what happened to the Enron employees. But I think it's important for the future. I think that we're going to have to really look at the fact that every working American should have an ability to have a voice in their workplace and fully participate if we're going to have the kind of productivity and kind of outputs we want.
Sam, back to you.
Thank you. Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I would say that the union movement could really strengthen itself in this country were it to begin to speak to this age issue, because there's such a huge bulge of people dealing with it, and cease kind of speaking the old 30s revolutionary rhetoric. You know, the union movement would resonate wonderfully with this problem. By the way, the other issue is getting retrained. When I had to, you know, come up with the $11,000-$12,000 to, by the way, go to one of Boston University's programs, there was nowhere in the public sector or in the world of loans and grants that I could find something for ostensibly middle class, you know, 50-something-year-old guy. I mean, there were all kinds of loans for every minute, you know, minority group and other groups that deserve help. But for the guys that are supposedly the power people and therefore we don't need help, I couldn't find anything. And so, you know, that's the retraining issue that I brought up a few moments ago.
Okay, Jim Ostreicher, from the perspective of private industry, the report is saying unequivocally that something needs to be done to encourage business to put the money into retraining workers, like Sam, like the 23-year-old recently arrived immigrant. But David made the point earlier, why would you train your competition if the worker's only going to be there for 2 years? What's the answer?
I think Sam brought up some terrific points, and first I would compliment him on his description of reinventing himself. The economy kind of has to reinvent itself as it changes from knowledge to information, from manufacturing, from agriculture. There's consistent displacement of one kind of skills that you grew up and were trained for, and all of a sudden that particular segment of the economy is not quite as in demand as another segment. Sam retrained himself to go from broadcasting, I guess it was, to computers. He referenced Bill Gates. The challenge then becomes, how does industry, government, and society create a mechanism to retrain workers at all income levels so that they can take advantage of new opportunities in the workforce? And while they're doing that, how can their benefits be more transportable? It's not always possible to correct all the problems in a specific company or a specific industry. We have to look at this in a larger perspective of the entire economy.
One other thought. You know, we also looked at the Aspen Institute at some very successful programs that brought together labor, business, and certainly the public, and the Wisconsin Regional Program. There's a variety of programs out there that are quite successful in understanding that employers need to come together as a group, labor movement needs to come together with them, and there needs to be some public input in terms of dollars to ensure that workers can go there and be retrained for another job and move up the ladder.
All right, Sam, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255. And to Louisville, Kentucky, Chris is on the line. Hi, Chris. Chris, are you there? I think we may have lost that line. To Charlotte, Vermont, Frank, are you there? Hey, Frank, can you hear me? You seem to be having some difficulty with our telephone lines here. Let me just, while we get that technical stuff sorted out, David, ask you to take the point that Sam raised to some kind of, real politics solution. Because, you know, it's great to bring disparate groups of people together. It's great to, you know, spend the amount of time in the field that you have and come up with a report that people can hold. Somebody has to wave this in front of politicians who need to be reelected, saying this is a problem now, when there is no big bang in the business page headlines. There's nothing that says this needs to be fixed right away. So how do you focus people on it?
Well, it's a challenge, and this is part of the answer, we hope. We've certainly already heard from a number of congressional committees that would like to be briefed and so forth, and our hope is that even in the midst of elections and recessions and concerns about September 11th, that the longer-term future of our country, which may depend as much or more on these kinds of things, can be brought to the attention of thoughtful people. We involve politicians here. There were governors. There were people who had been the chief of staff in the Reagan administration, senior domestic policy advisors to the George W. Bush, and so on. But also, you know, part of what this group did was not shirk responsibility for itself. The part of the point of bringing together this group of leaders is we have to reach out to our own constituencies and make the pitch. And, you know, a second part of this I would just say is that everyone's going to have to take some responsibility. One of the things we first agreed on, it was a real challenge for us, is a covenant, a set of principles that says, look, work has to be the foundation of American values, but if you work, you shouldn't be poor. That, you know, people should be willing to move and change jobs the way Sam has, but when they do, that ought to increase their security, not reduce it. So we have a series of things that...
So what do? You reward mobility or you reward loyalty? Do you have to make a choice?
Well, there are some choices, and businesses are making those choices every day. But part of what you ought to do is make sure, for example, that when you move from job to job, you don't lose your pension benefits. You don't lose your health coverage. And it's one of the major problems that still face this economy. And, you know, the same thing has to do with families and children that we've talked about. And one of the interesting features about this group, this is not a group of people that are interested in highfalutin figures, facts, talk, and so forth. We wanted to be as concrete as we could to point the way to answers. And so we tried to be very specific. We're going to work with the Congress. We're going to work with anyone that will listen, frankly, to try and make a difference, because this is our future. There's no single right answer. But if a group this diverse, that you can even hear disagreements on these phone lines, mm-hmm. this diverse can come up, you know, a broad framework of options and answers. I think there is some hope for the future, but only if people pay attention.
Connection listeners, Connection callers, we have our technical problems ironed out now, so join us on the program. 1-800-423-8255. We're interested in what you can tell us about your workplace and how you think it is changing or should be changed to adapt to the future. If we take away today's business page headlines and look at what the workplace is going to be like for our children, for our younger brothers and sisters. 1-800-423-TALK. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com. From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour we're talking about the workplace, how it's changing, how it's going to change whether we want it to or would like it to or not. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. We'll go straight to the calls to Indiana. Orleans, Indiana. Nick's on the line. Hi, Nick.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm like Sam. I'm one of these guys in my 50s who have been in manufacturing for over the last 30 years. And the big thing I've seen is that we no longer want to be in manufacturing in this country. We're becoming a service-oriented. I've been involved in the automotive supplier business, components and things like that. And all of those jobs are moving to Mexico, moving to South America, moving to China, Asia. You know, we're just an exporter of technology. And, you can understand a business, I guess, when you watch, if I can pay a worker $2 an hour in Mexico and I have to pay them $10 an hour here. And I don't see that changing. Big business is short-sighted. All they're looking at is next quarter. They're not looking at next year or even 5 years down the road.
Well, David, you wrote the essay, How Did We Get Here?, as part of this report in terms of looking at globalization and these forces that are on the economy. You know, you listen to Nick describe the situation that he knows, and that's a common story in terms of the way the economy's changing.
You bet it is, and businesses are feeling competition from all different sources, and there's kind of been two strategies out there. One strategy has been to sort of get lean and mean and treat workers the same way they treat any other inventory. First, you know, when we need them, we take them. When we don't, we don't. this report is trying to provide a wake-up call to us all, to workers that they're going to have to be willing to change careers and so forth, but to businesses that we have to work together to find ways to make sure we train and retain and keep key workers. You know, the only workers of the future are going to be people like Nick and Sam. They're people over 55. We're going to have no growth of the native-born 25 to 54-year-old workers in the next 20 years. None. That's a huge change.
You're saying the biggest challenge is to business to make sure that Sam is valued at the workplace.
If business doesn't do this and only works on next quarter or getting through the next recession, they're not going to have the Sams to work because they can no longer rely on a ready stream of young workers entering the workforce. So business is going to have to do something. But look, you can't blame it all on business. That's the point of this group. You know, workers often haven't been as willing as they need to be to get new skills and so forth, or is able to because they haven't been paid enough. So what this report says is let's figure out ways to work together so that people can get the training they need, so that immigrants can be integrated as part of the nation, because, again, we need every worker, we need everybody to participate, and business has got to start looking over the long term, not just over the next quarterly report.
Okay, Jim and Beth, yeah. This Nick's story really puts us at the nexus of where the economy is and where we're going. This whole issue of globalization and Jim, of having to be competitive, competing against countries in Mexico or overseas, and Beth making the argument that those companies can continue to pay a living wage to workers. I mean, how do we get over the hurdle? Jim, why don't you start?
Nick, I think one of the fundamentals we need to discuss a little bit is in, if not rapidly approaching, a world economy, and the economies of other countries are becoming more educated, more technological. Communication is such, like this program today, that we can instantly communicate with each other. It doesn't take months to get something from Europe in terms of information or technology. So the entire world is competing for business. And the entire world will be competing for workers. And as the economy changes into different areas of from manufacturing, we're still a huge manufacturing country, but technology has made us so much more productive. And whether that production is done in this country or elsewhere, we have to find answers to training our people to be even more productive so that native-born Americans get the first choice of available jobs.
I mean, Nick, I really hear you and empathize. I mean, one of the things it seems to me that as a country, just on a global front, it seems to me we need to come up with some basic standards of how we are going to compete in the global marketplace so that another nation who fails to allow people to organize, that uses child labor, a whole variety of things like that, that our workers don't have to compete with those nations that do those things to their workers. But more importantly, if we're going to be in a global economy, it seems to me that we as a country need to say those who get displaced by this global economy have the right to be retrained, have the right to move on to other jobs. And the most important thing I want to say is it's absolutely true. You point out, Nick, that what's happening in the United States is the manufacturing sector has decreased dramatically. And what's happened is you now have a large service sector. And a lot of those jobs actually aren't even competing globally. Your nursing home care worker, your child care worker, your grocery store worker, your department store worker, a variety of these jobs, while certainly the global economy has an impact on them, I think we need to really look at these jobs and see why, in fact, they're not getting adequate wages and adequate benefits. It's not those jobs certainly aren't because they're competing globally. But I think the thing that we really need to talk about, and I think David points out, we need to look at this together. There needs to be retraining. Businesses and labor need to come together and talk about how we're going to be a productive society in which every worker gets a fair share of that.
Nick, thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you.
Nice to have you on the program. To Hilton Head, South Carolina now. Rick's on the program. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Fine, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a small employer here in South Carolina, and I have a problem with your taking public benefits that are that currently employers pay for. Your suggestion that we should work with Congress so that people don't have to worry about taking their pension from employer A to employer B disincentivizes that employer from giving you a better pension. All right, the reason that we put in good benefits is to attract and retain employees. Okay, in order to retain those employees, we have to do a better job as individual employers. When we do that, we should be rewarded with our employees considering and very seriously losing those benefits if they go to another employer.
Like a penalty for leaving. David?
It's not a penalty for leaving. It
acts like that on the mind of the worker, doesn't it, Rick?
Well, yeah, but you have to understand something. I mean, this is money that I don't have to pay. All right? I'm paying it because of the fact that I want to attract and retain my employees. I'm going to pay more than the guy down the street does. All right, as a result, the employee should look at it and say, well, gee whiz, you know, this guy must think more of me and think more of my skills than the guy down the street if he's not offering me as much money, as much benefits.
Rick, just stay with us here. I want to bring David in on this. David?
Uh-huh, thank you.
This was certainly an area that we spent a lot of time discussing because the view you express is absolutely valid and quite understandable. An awful lot of employers have used pensions as a way of hanging on to workers that they want to keep. And, you know, I don't think we're calling for instantaneous, complete flexibility on pensions and so forth. But, of course, sometimes this works the other way, that people who lose their jobs also lose their pension. People who have to move on because a business goes out of is changing its direction and so forth. I think you got to find some happy medium here, and indeed, the Congress has worked over the last few years to try and find some way to mix them. But you know, there are various ways you can retain employees. Pensions are just one, and I'm sure you already said you probably pay higher wages. You provide other kinds of supports and so on. But let me be very clear: this is not a report that's primarily about imposing new rules or restrictions on a bunch of folks. This group could never have agreed on that. Rather, it sort of says, look, we're going to ask workers to be flexible, to move on, and so forth. But in exchange, they can't lose all their security every time they change jobs. Now, obviously, we're asking businesses to do more, too, and that means you've got to have the tools that you need to help retain workers. So I think it's one of these things where we have to work together to find the happy medium, just that we're not there now.
Rick, thanks a lot for your call.
I appreciate that. I would like to say one thing about giving employees flexibility to leave. If you invest a certain amount of money in training them, then you have to invest that money in retraining them. You're talking about retraining outside of the workplace, and I think that retraining outside of the workplace does not make a lot of sense for small employers. And you guys have to look at it from the broad view. The broad view is that the majority of employers in the United States are small employers. They're not large employers. And that's an important consideration. And in making these suggestions, you have to consider the impact that you're going to have on small employers who are doing more niche things than a Detroit, like a GM or a Ford or a
actually, much of our focus is actually that way. We think the training has to be done by employers, within the employment, within the workplace, closely connected, and much was focused on the small business, precisely for the reason you say. The issue is not the great big companies. It's the small companies who can't afford to train their workers and then have them leave and go somewhere else. So that's why it needs to be done more in groups.
This is Jim here. Rick, I compliment you on your expression of your points. Flexibility often comes in when there's a structural change and a company no longer is not encouraging workers to leave from successful companies. But how does a society deal with the issues when a particular company goes out of business or a particular industry is out of favor? How do we help those workers find new jobs in more productive industries? not changing the rules for successful ones.
There's something in the preamble of the report, Beth, that you participated in. David uses the words economic patriotism. Now, that came to mean something different after September 11th, obviously. But in terms of people getting together and saying, what's best for the country?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there's the will there from among the people who are struggling to make it, the small employers and the union officers, to say, you know, we do need a different way of doing things, so we better sit down and start talking about it and agreeing on it?
Well, certainly unions are already doing that now. I mean, the unions...
But that's a survival thing for the unions,
no,
in part,
no,
isn't
it? No, really it isn't. I think it's been really a change and an understanding that they're part of making sure that America is productive and want to fully participate in that process. I think, you know, you mentioned something, Dick, that I think is really important when you talk about, certainly in the wake of 9/11, where we certainly have come together as a country, certainly out of fear. But I think there needs to be something different. And the report and that David has put together and the group at the Aspen Institute and all that participated understood that if we're going to come together as a people, it can't be just out of fear. It has to be out of a common sense of purpose that all of us are part of this society, that we all have to participate, that we all have responsibilities, but that also there's some obligations once one fulfills those responsibilities. And I think we as a country need to really think about this hard when we talk about patriotism.
Jim, are you on board with this?
To get real behavioral change requires that there be some incentive, either real or perceived, on the parts of all parties. Industry needs qualified, motivated workers. Workers need affordable wages, workable benefits, lifestyle support in terms of child care. And society needs it all to work. And so all parties working together have to develop the appropriate incentives that make it worthwhile for workers to invest their time, for business to do their part, and for government to affect change.
David, in 15 seconds or less, 5 years in the making and another 5 years in the explaining and getting people to read it and pay attention?
Yeah, you bet. But, you know, this is a wake-up call. The wind's going to be in our faces, and we're going to have to learn how to tack much very quickly.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
David Elwood, director of the Aspen Institute Report, a labor economist at Harvard. Jim Ostreicher, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jim's a former chairman of JCPenney. And Beth Shulman, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Beth is former vice president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. You can continue the conversation by going to our forums on our webpage. We're at theconnection.org. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. This is the